Okay. An outline, government and the family, who is to train children? And should the government restrict the discipline of children? And the issue, point A on the outline, should parents or the government have the primary responsibility for training children? And so now the biblical teaching. I'm going to just go over the whole outline, the big points, just to show where we're going. Number one, I think government should promote bearing children. Number two, I'm going to say, who has the right to train the children and to decide how they're trained? Should it be government or parents? And I'm going to say parents. Number three, I'm going to talk about a school voucher program that would give parents choices of where to send their kids. And number four, I'm going to talk about discipline of children and spanking. And number five, what about moral standards in public schools? Should they be taught to children? So that's sort of the whole overview. I hope we can get to all of this morning. And what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to step back and say, okay, we have schools. We have schools to train children in our country. Now, does the Bible say anything about this? Well, let's just think through what training of children is. What schools, what are schools? Well, they're a way of training children. Now does the Bible speak to that? Yes, I think the Bible speaks to that. There is a principle that has to do with the Bible's teaching on who should train children and how they should be trained. And I'm trying to apply that teaching of the Bible to this whole question of schools. And once we see the biblical principles about training children, then I think it will help us have foundational convictions that will influence what we think about political decisions having to do with schools and how the education system should be set up. So that's where I'm going. Number one, promotion of bearing children. First thing, before we even get to schools, the government should encourage and give incentives for married couples to bear and raise children for the good of society. That maybe seems like an obvious point, but not all governments think that. Some governments discourage having children or bearing children and think we have too many people. Government of China has one family, one child policy has had for years. But look, right at the beginning of creation, Genesis 1:27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. So the first command that God gave to human beings was to have children. First command. That was what he said we were supposed to do here on earth, to fill the earth. And the Bible views children in a positive way. Psalm 127, verse 3, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Malachi 2:15, what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring, having to do with marriage. God is seeking godly offspring. And 1 Timothy 5:14, Paul says, I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. I think that's a positive thing. And then how that applies to politics in general, we should say our governments in the United States and state and local governments and in other countries, governments should view the bearing of children as a positive thing, something that is to be encouraged. Number one, unless each generation bears and raises as many children as themselves, society will dwindle and go out of existence. And you have some civilizations that have just done that. They've dwindled down to nothing. And tribal cultures and things in past history. And in Europe right now, we have a declining birth rate. Japan, the same thing, declining birth rate. And pretty soon there'll be all older people in the society and very few younger people left. And then, number two, unless a new generation of young workers comes along, the society will become top-heavy. And the economy will spiral downward. So you have more and more people being supported in retirement, but fewer and fewer people to support them. And then number three, very important, society passes on its cultural values and moral teachings and behavioral standards through its children. So we should realize that bearing children and then raising them in the things that the culture values and treasures and wants to perpetuate, that's important because we don't live forever. We die and then what's going to happen if we go on after that? Now, number two, education and parental rights. My argument here is that parents, not the government, should have the primary responsibility for educating and training their children. and should have freedom to decide how best to do this. Why? Well, look at what the Bible says about training children. It starts out in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And what's the next thing? These words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. There Moses is telling the parents that they should teach God's ways to their children. They have to pass on these teachings to the next generation. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise, just during the ordinary conversations of life, talking about God's ways and God's teachings and his truths and his standards. And then many other verses in Proverbs talk about fathers or fathers and mothers or parents instructing children. Proverbs 1:8, hear my son, your father's instruction, forget not your mother, forsake not your mother's teaching. Proverbs 4:1, hear, O sons, a father's instruction. Proverbs 6:20, my son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. Proverbs 10:1, a wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. Proverbs 13:1, a wise son hears his father's instruction. Proverbs 15:20, a wise son makes a glad father. Proverbs 23:22, listen to your father who gave you life and do not despise your mother when she is old. Proverbs 31, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught them. You go over to the New Testament, children, obey your parents in the Lord. And then on the next page, Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Colossians 3:20, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. You look at all those verses, there is no indication at all that the government has the responsibility to bring up children, or for training children, or for deciding what children should be taught. This is contrary to the philosophy of our current educational system that thinks that educational experts in the school boards and the school systems should have the final say on what is to be taught. The Bible's perspective is parents should have that final say. Now, how that can work in actual practice is that parents get elected school boards, and school boards then tell the teachers what they're supposed to teach. And that's what should happen. And we have a great privilege in the United States still that school boards are still locally elected and there's still local control of school systems and school curriculum. But more and more it's becoming state and national level dominated, where it's much harder for parents to have effective influence. Anyway, the responsibility for teaching and training children, according to the Bible, falls entirely on their parents. Now, does that mean I'm opposed to publicly funded schools for children? No, I'm not opposed to that. I think that the way to understand it, however, is that public schools should be seen as a help for parents in bringing up their children, but that parents should have the final say on what their children are taught and how the children are taught. And if tax money is used to support public schools, then that's fine. I don't have any objection to that, as long as it doesn't take over the decision-making process of what children are taught and how they are taught. Therefore, number one, parents, not the government, should have the freedom to decide how best to educate their children. And parents should never begin to think the public school system is replacing the parents as the party primarily responsible for training children. Schools help parents. They aren't the primary responsible party. Now, that is the opposite of communist countries that take children from their families at a very early age and indoctrinate them in communist propaganda. That's very typical of totalitarian governments, because they know if they can brainwash children at a very early age into their viewpoint, then they can control the whole population. Sadly, not only communist countries, but some other countries that are democratic countries have begun to strongly act in a direct contradiction of this idea of parental control. So, one way to know if a society believes that parents should have the final responsibility and authority for training their children, one way to know is to ask, well, do they allow homeschooling? And another question, do they allow alternative private schools for children to go to schools? If they allow that, they're still giving freedom to parents to decide. But if they don't, then they're not. And so in September 2006, the European Court of Human Rights outlawed homeschooling in Germany. And homeschooling families have been threatened with state seizure of their children and imprisonment. And I have a quotation here from Attorney Benjamin Bull of the Alliance Defense Fund, who is a member of this church and who has taught this class. He said, "The decision by the European Court of Human Rights opens the door to continued prosecution and should highlight to Americans the extreme dangers of allowing international law to be authoritative in our own court systems." So, for instance, in June 2008, two German parents, Jürgen and Rosemary Dudek, were sentenced to 3 months in prison for homeschooling their children in Germany. Sent to prison for homeschooling their children. And there was a family that was granted, I don't have it here in my notes, but a German family came to the United States and they appealed and were granted political asylum in the United States because they wanted to homeschool their children. And the government was forcibly taking their children away from them. But is that happening here? July 2009, just last year, a 10-year-old girl in New Hampshire who was homeschooled was ordered by a judge to attend public school because the girl, quote, appeared to reflect her mother's rigidity on questions of faith, close quotes. And the girl's best interests, quote, would be best served in a public school setting where different points of view would be presented at a time when she must begin to critically evaluate multiple systems of belief. So that's a worrisome situation. And hope it doesn't spread here. But you know, then I thought about that. It's not surprising that Sweden, Germany, that have strayed so far from their strong, Bible-centered, Protestant, Lutheran traditions and have become so secularized and so anti-Christian as a society, it's not surprising that those societies that lose more and more of their Christian orientation will begin to think, well, the government knows all and the government should control everything and can take children away from their parents. That would be an exceptionally difficult situation for Christians to live in those countries. Okay, number three. I want to talk about a school voucher system. A voucher is this. It would be a little piece of paper that I give to Alan. Say Alan has young children at home. I know he don't anymore. I give it to Alan, and I say, Alan, now you can use this voucher for $2,000, $4,000, $5,000. You can take it to any school you want to. And you can pay your children's school fees with this voucher. Now, what that does is it gives Alan the freedom to decide which school he wants his children to go to. They can go to the local public school. They can go to a charter school if they want to. They can go to a Roman Catholic school. And in many inner city situations, there are still Roman Catholic schools that do a really good job of training children in basic educational standards. And parents want to send them, but they need some funding to do that. Or you can go to a private evangelical Christian school, like Scottsdale Christian Academy or something like that. And so that's a big equalizer because it lets parents decide where they're going to send their children. And it's a wonderful system because it introduces competition into the educational system. And competition always results in a better product. Now, isn't there a Diamondbacks game this afternoon? Is there a Diamondbacks game this afternoon? Yes. Bob tells me yes. Okay. Let's imagine that the Diamondbacks go out on the field and the other team doesn't show up. Now, maybe they get some coach to go out and do the pitching or something. How well are the Diamondbacks going to play with no competition? It's just going to be like a batting practice. You know, it'll be a practice. But you don't play You don't play well when there's no team competing against you. Right? And if the public school system is the only system that has a chance of training people, it's like going out on the playing field without an opposing team. And you kind of do a good job, and you hope you look like you're doing all right, and so the school board thinks it's okay. But there's not the incentive that comes with somebody else. Oh, wait a minute, that other school down the street is doing this level of achievement in math. Well, maybe we can revise our program to do that level. And do you see what I'm saying? And same way it is in companies. I remember talking to a man that worked for a company that made postage sorting machines, mail sorting machines. And he was trying to get his engineers to design this machine that would sort so many thousand pieces of letters of mail a minute, and yet a certain level of quietness. And they did the best they could, and he said, I think it can be faster, and I think it can be quieter. And they said, no, it's physically impossible, it can't happen. And then he said he heard about, in a Chicago suburb, a new postage sorting machine made by a German engineering firm that was doing it faster and quieter. So he just made an appointment for his engineers to go see that other machine. And they looked at it, and they said, well, I guess it can be done. All of a sudden, the other group doing it better spurs you on to try to do better. And so we don't have a system of competition in education today. And because of that, we don't have, I think, the quality that we could. So it seems to me a school voucher system should be adopted by every school district in the entire United States. Number one, it would restore more parental influence in training children. Number two, it would establish healthy competition in the educational system. Number three, it would allow parents to send children to schools that supported their own moral and behavioral values. That would be really important. Christian parents could send children to Christian school. Or Roman Catholic parents might choose a Roman Catholic school. Protestant parents might choose an evangelical Christian school. Muslim parents might choose a Muslim school. Jewish parents might choose a Jewish school. I think that's entirely fine. Because if the children are being trained and they're being educated, they're doing it in such a way that the school is helping the parents, and the parents are the determiners of what kind of education the children get. And then children would be better educated. Now I want to say something about the results currently of the public school system in the United States. And I've got Sherry sitting in the front row here, who's been a public school teacher for much of her life, and a number of others of you are teachers, and you know teachers. I know Bob's been very involved, and was school superintendent or chief of operations for Oakland and Chicago. Some of you have been just unbelievably dedicated and devoted and doing a wonderful job, but I'm going to argue, and you can argue back to me if you want, I'm going to argue that the system as it is structured in many ways hinders high achievement for teachers, and Sherry's nodding your head, rather than helps high achievement for teachers and for schools. And how do I know that? I know that by comparing the results with what happens in other countries. In a 2006 study of educational achievement, the United States ranked 21st out of 30 countries in science. Why should we rank 21st out of 30 countries in science? 25th out of 30 in math. Why should we do that? Now, 25th out of 30, that isn't like first place at all. It isn't even tied for first place. It doesn't come close. 25th out of 30 in math. In a recent survey of Oklahoma public school students, only 1 in 4 could identify George Washington as the first president of the United States. That's terrible. Now, why do I think we should be number one among all the countries of the world in educational achievement? It's because our university system is number one. You see surveys of top universities in the world, and a whole lot of them are clustered right up there at United States universities. So what happens is people go off to university, and high-achieving students do fabulously well. And the university systems produce PhDs and produce Nobel Prize winners and great inventions and things like that. So it isn't that Americans are stupid. but it's that the educational system with the government monopoly of elementary school education, of funding for education, isn't doing the best job. Well, wait a minute. Why do they do better at the university level? Ah, there's competition. Because you can go to ASU, or you can go to NAU, or you can go to a private college, or you can go to places out of state, and schools are competing in trying to get the best quality of education. And so all of a sudden, when competition enters into the system, the quality goes up. Well, would it be helpful if we'd spend more money on the same system? Well, let's see. Washington, D.C. has the third highest per capita expenditure per student in the United States, third highest, and it was last in achievement. Delaware had the eighth highest spending, but it landed in the bottom third with regard to results, and those statistics can go on. Spending more money is not the solution. It's changing the system, the structure of the system. And so let's see where I am on the outline. Well, this voucher system sounds like a good idea, but some people say, wait a minute, oh no, this will mean parents using vouchers to send children to church-related schools, and the government will be supporting a certain religion. Answer, it's not the government supporting a certain church-related school, it's the parents of the children, because they are making the choice of where to send their children. And this was upheld in a Supreme Court decision in 2002 in the case Zelman v. Simmons Hardens. It decided that a limited school voucher program in Cleveland, Ohio, was allowed under the U.S. Constitution because basically, when I give this voucher to Alan, then it's Alan to spend where he wants. And he can go spend it at Scottsdale Christian Academy if he wants, or a Jewish school if he wants, or a charter school or a public school. He is supporting the school. It's not the government supporting the school. And Alan paid the taxes to start out. So it was his question is, whose money is it to start with? Good. Good. So if the program has a valid secular purpose, educating children, if the aid goes to parents and not the schools, which it does with vouchers, if there's a broad class of beneficiaries, if it's neutral with respect to religion, you can choose any school you want to, a religious school or not, and if there's adequate non-religious options, then the court in a 5-4 decision said this is okay. Now, so you think, oh, this is great. This would be a great system. Everybody gets the vouchers. Parents can decide where to send their children. And we'd introduce competition to the public school system, and our school systems would be transformed. However, there is a group that opposes vouchers. And that group is called the National Education Association. It's the largest teachers' union. And what happened in 2007, and they pour huge amounts of money into opposing any voucher system when it's proposed. So in 2007, the state of Utah established a statewide voucher system. Everybody was really happy. The NEA mounted a massive political campaign, spent millions of dollars, and got it on a statewide referendum, and said, oh, this is going to ruin our educational system. This is a disaster. Vote against it. And the state actually voted it down. Why? I think because there was a very wealthy special interest group, the National Education Association, that opposed vouchers. And there was who represents parents? Parents. But there wasn't like a wealthy, well-funded, well-organized group to represent parents. And when you've got one powerful group opposing it and just a diverse collection of people supporting it, it didn't win. So, and there are other examples of that. Now, I want to add something else here that is very troubling to me. And that is that what happens in effect in the United States is that some parents have a high enough income that they can choose where they live. And when they can choose where they live, they choose neighborhoods that have better schools and have higher expectations of teachers and students. and therefore they're able to exercise school choice by exercising housing choice. But there are other people in the United States who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum, and they can't afford to choose to live in places that have high educational standards in the public schools, and so they're trapped in poorly performing public schools, and they don't have the option of a voucher system to get them out. And there are two senior researchers at the Manhattan Institute who have basically devoted their lifetimes to studying this, Abigail Thernstrom and Stephen Thernstrom. And I'm going to put this up on the board. This book, No Excuses, Closing the Racial Gap in Learning, published by Simon & Schuster, 2003. Abigail Thernstrom, member of the Massachusetts State Board of Education, commissioner on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York. Stephen Thernstrom, Winthrop Professor of History at Harvard University, Bancroft Award-winning author of several groundbreaking books and also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, was recently appointed to the governing body of the National Endowment of the Humanities. The Thernstroms, in other words, are at the elite academic level in terms of educational scholarship as far as the United States is concerned. What do they say? They say that there is an incredible, astounding racial gap in the educational achievements in the United States. And I want to show you this chart, which I think should break your heart. This compares scores in reading, 1998, mathematics, 2000, U.S. history, 2001, and geography. So we've got four areas: reading, math, history, and geography. And it compares white eighth graders in this dark bar with black 12th graders, Asian eighth graders, and Hispanic 12th graders. So let me see if I've got, no. The two middle bars are black and Hispanic, and the right bar is Asian. So what we're seeing in reading, national average for educational achievement among students in the United States, in reading skills, white eighth graders on average score higher than black and almost higher than Hispanic 12th graders. Higher than black 12th graders and almost higher than Hispanic. White 8th graders in math score higher than black 12th graders or Hispanic 12th graders in math. And Asians are a little bit higher in math. And white 8th graders in U.S. history score higher and almost the same as Hispanic 12th graders in U.S. history and higher than Asian. And in geography, white 8th graders score significantly higher than black 12th graders, Hispanic 12th graders, and Asian 8th graders. The Thernstroms say this: another generation of black children is drifting through school without acquiring essential skills and knowledge. Hispanic children are not faring much better. And for neither group is there comforting trend in the direction of progress. And for those of us in Arizona, I think the Hispanic trends are particularly troublesome as well because of the large Hispanic population. By 12th grade on average, black students are 4 years behind those who are white or Asian. Hispanics don't do much better. Now, they're talking about national averages. There are exceptions. There are, of course, many, many individual exceptions. But as a whole, this is what happens. And then they say, imagine that you are an employer considering two job applicants, one with a high school diploma, the other a dropout at the end of eighth grade. An employer will seldom find the choice between the two candidates difficult. The employer hiring the typical black high school graduate or the college that admits the average black student is, in effect, choosing a youngster who has made it only through eighth grade. He or she will have a high school diploma, but not the skills that should come with it. Blacks nearing the end of their high school education perform a little worse than white eighth graders in both reading and U.S. history, and a lot worse in math. math and geography. Hispanics do only a little better. This, I believe, is a national tragedy of immense proportions. Lack of educational skills perpetuates a permanent economic underclass in our society, for education is the primary determinant of earning capacity for life. These are my words, not the Thernstroms. But the responsibility for this tragedy lies squarely with the failed public school system. Throwing more money at the same failed schools will not solve the problem, Thernstroms point out, because the teachers' unions have such a stranglehold on public schools that poor teachers cannot be fired and the best teachers cannot be given enough incentives to excel or stay in teaching at a career, at least in the low-performing schools. The Thernstroms write, now I'm back to quoting them, big city superintendents as well as principals operate in a straitjacket. The enormous power of teachers' unions stops almost all real change in its tracks. It is no accident that the revolutionary schools that we describe in chapters 3 and 4, they have case studies of some very high-performing schools in poor neighborhoods. The revolutionary schools we describe in chapters 3 and 4 are outside the traditional public school system. Then they say, we have described some wonderful public schools where youngsters living in distressed communities thrive, but it is no accident that none of them is a traditional public school. They are charter schools. The principals in these charter schools have real power over their budgets, their discipline policies, and their staffing. The job of unions is to protect the interests of teachers. The job of schools is to educate the students. Many well-meaning reformers fail to understand the difference between the two objectives. Where there's a vacancy, the most senior applicant gets the position. Quality is irrelevant. Getting rid of an unwanted teacher can be an expensive nightmare. Tenured teachers who can't teach, can't control a class, and behave in manifestly unacceptable ways are in the system as long as they want to stay, with rare exceptions. And then the Thernstroms conclude, vouchers are a matter of basic equity. Middle-class parents are people who can choose where their children go to school by choosing where they live. But choice should not be a class-based privilege. The racial gap is thus the most important civil rights issue of our time. If Americans care about racial equality, they must demand more than the current reform movement is offering. They must demand standards, tests, some consequences for educational failure, and limited public school choice. 10:20. Well, I didn't get through the whole outline. Bob, you want to comment? I'll just wait till you get the microphone. I know you have a huge amount more knowledge than I do in this area.
Well, the comments that you're making just bring back so many memories of terrible things that what you're saying is very true. Mm-hmm. Your last comment about teachers having tenure and not being able to be fired. I was with the Los Angeles Unified School District for 24 years, and once a year, and we would have them in different geographic areas, but all of the principals would get together, maybe 50 or 60 in one geographic area, like elementary school principals, and you would have what we'd call the Dance of the Lemons. And that is where they would all have to identify the worst teachers that they had. And their colleague at another school would be obligated to take them because we couldn't fire them. Mm. And in a city like Los Angeles, it would be thousands of teachers would be involved in the Dance of the Lemons. Wow. Because of that kind of a restriction.
Wow.
Many other stories to substantiate what you're saying.
Bob, I know you've told me this in the past, but you have done professional consulting, evaluating citywide school systems at Houston, mm-hmm. New York City, what other large cities like that? Is that right?
Yeah, about 24 different cities.
Yeah.
All very large. Houston turned out to be the best of all of those. And Houston was unique in the sense that it actually had management plans goals and objectives, timelines, and missions that they developed year after year, and people were held accountable to that. And in the others, like Philadelphia was probably one of the worst run school districts I have ever seen in my life, other than New Orleans. That had to be, that didn't even get onto the scale. But in Philadelphia, that was union run from top to bottom. Even if you were called a superintendent, you didn't run that school district at all. Pretty sad.
Thanks.
This book that you refer to, I've got to get that. That is great. When you were showing the difference between the Anglo and the Hispanic and blacks, when I was a brand new teacher and I needed more money, I also taught night school. And I taught at a Thomas Jefferson High School in Los Angeles, and it was all black. And I taught American literature. And so in those days, I had maybe 65, 70 people in a class. But I had to read to them the stories because none of the students could read.
What age?
11th. Well, they aged, they would probably be young adults.
What grade?
11th grade, American literature.
Amazing.
Pretty sad.
But a tragedy for our nation. A national tragedy, a scandal. And the National Education Association is directly responsible for it. And I think they have a huge amount of accountability for it. But it's not only the NEA, it's the lack of choice. It's the lack of a voucher system that would solve the problem. So, okay, over here in the back, two people.
I think it was about a month ago. I was watching the news, and they fired the whole school board of the state of Rhode Island. And I'm not quite sure the ins and outs of it, but I applaud the whole state getting behind it, saying, hey, you're not cutting it with our kids, educating them. And they just fired the whole school board all the way down. But what was the issue on that?
I don't know, but see, they didn't fire the union. So if you don't fire the union, you get a new school board and you get the same problems. And they didn't institute school choice. What's your name?
Kathy. Parsons. I taught for 25 years in Michigan and a public school, and I can tell you that we were extremely accountable to the point of handing in our lesson plans every week, our principal meeting with us, going over them, you know, setting objectives, you know, testing, meeting, if the students...
So you were in a good school system.
Yes. But I will also like to speak to the fact that for the first 3 years before you're granted tenure, you can be let go at any time with no explanation, nothing. If principals get into your classroom and administrators and observe that you are you know, not up to snuff, they have no problem letting you go.
So you were in a better system.
Well, this was, you know, even statewide, though, as far as tenure. And once you're on tenure, the only difference there is they must prove that, you know, you are not doing your job. And they set up a plan. They need to come in. They need to help you. And if the teacher does not respond and does not improve, and then they can, you know, take you, you know, to the tenure board. And I've seen teachers, you know, lose their jobs. But
okay. Thanks for that. And I appreciate the balancing comment because what's your name, Shirley? What's your name?
Kathy.
Margaret and I, our three sons all graduated from Libertyville High School in Illinois, and 95% or so of the students in Libertyville High School went on to college. So it was an unbelievably good school. So there are public school systems where they've gotten rid of the bad teachers, and somehow the system works to do that. And so I'm thankful for those. But the problem is lower income communities just can't do that and aren't doing that in so many cases. And that's the problem. Okay. And basically, in Libertyville, there was choice because there was a really good Catholic school nearby. And if students weren't getting the training, the parents, Catholics or not, would send their children to the Catholic school where they knew they'd learn math and reading, and the 11th graders could read the American literature. Okay.
Wayne, I've been a public school teacher for 27 years.
Yep.
And I'm the most conservative teacher at the school.
Yep.
And I've been voted favorite teacher many, many times. And I just say that to give what I say some credibility.
Okay.
The problem with what's happening here is that the vouchers will probably make all schools public. Even if that money goes to a private school, that school now comes under the auspices of government committees. What's happening here is conservatives are favoring what's happening at public schools with all the outcomes. It's outcome-based education, which started in the 1970s. And conservatives favor it because we don't trust public educators. And we think that they do a bad job quite often. Although most of us can't remember too many teachers we had that were really bad. Liberals favor this because it's going to guarantee outcomes. It will guarantee equality. The Thernstroms are Obama supporters, and they are supporters of Race to the Top, which is going to radically change public education, because next year at my school, we will have something approximating scripted teaching, which means I can no longer teach Adam Smith, Karl Marx, Judeo-Christian ethics. Those will not be on the script. So, and all of my students, my racial breakdown of students I pass must be the same. I cannot flunk more blacks than whites as a percentage. This is the future of what's happening here. This is what the Thernstroms advocate.
Okay. Tell me your name.
Kurt Saunders.
Kurt, thanks, Kurt. Thanks for that comment. I'm just, and I don't know where the Thernstroms are politically, they are clearly in favor of charter schools, and they're clearly in favor of vouchers because they say it's a matter of basic equity, allowing freedom of choice. Yeah, I know. So they said limited choice, so I want unlimited choice, but that's once the foot is in the door, or the camel's nose is under the tent, or something like that. But I guess I'm going to disagree with one thing you said, that vouchers make everything become government run. I don't think so. I think if you give the voucher to a privately run school, there may be some standards they have to meet, but they're going to have no trouble meeting the test achievement standards. And apart from that, there's freedom to fire, to hire, to discipline, and to set curriculum. And that's what I really want to have. So, okay. Who else? Sherry in front. We got a microphone coming here.
Largely, I think the focus in American education, at least in my school district, was performance on the Ames test, No Child Left Behind,
yep.
Which has forced you to work on teaching everyone equal.
Mm-hmm.
You teach the third grade curriculum. And I was opposed to that idea. I feel like my philosophy has always been to teach character and also take each child in your classroom as high as they can go.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And I went to the principal, I remember one time, and I showed him the results of my Ames test. And there were several, a large percentage of my class were functioning at the sixth grade level in
writing. Your third graders?
Yes, on the Ames test. And it really was terrific. And
wow.
He said, Sharon, I wish you'd just stick with the third grade curriculum. Have you ever stopped to think you give the fourth grade teacher nothing to teach?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And another factor that is not...
But, Sherry, I'm just going to stop there.
That's equality teaching.
Yeah, and that is putting the teacher's interests first, not the student's interest first. That's a classic comment. That's my concern is the fourth grade teacher, not my concern is the students achieving. And praising you because your children were achieving at a sixth grade level, that's amazing.
Well, see, he would rather have had me
dumb it
keep
down.
The top level students busy,
yeah.
And focus entirely on the ones that don't meet and exceed.
Yeah.
And I found that if I took every child as high as he could go, a lot of times it would make those lower students aspire higher because they could say, well, if he can do sixth grade level, I can do better.
Yep.
Then also there's another factor that I wanted to address on the statistics. Because of our immigration policies in the United States, a lot of your poor people, poor communities, have residents that are largely immigrants.
Yeah.
And you have people in your classroom who, in your third grade class, who just came across the border. They don't know the alphabet.
Yep.
They don't know even first grade reading.
Yep.
And you are, their scores are in your
I understand
stats.
That. Yep. Yep.
And so that is going to make it racially imbalanced. If that was, if that statistic showed that these are black children who have been in this country since birth, and all of those had been here all that time, it would be a terrible statistic. But if you take out the immigrants from those stats, I think you'd find that we do a fantastic job on our immigrants. We can catch them up very, very fast.
Yeah, that applies, Sherry, to the Hispanic part, but it
and
doesn't.
And to the black.
But it.
From there are a lot of people that come from, from Africa. There are a lot of.
That don't speak English.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And the Asians too. See, I just think that it's not as much of a factor then. Okay.
Well, good. You're right.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks very much. Well, we're getting a lot of comments. wait, now what time are we? Okay, back here. Okay, yeah, you've had your hand up for a long time. Thanks, Lorraine.
Two months ago, Phoenix...
What's your name?
Bob Merwin.
Bob.
Two months ago, the city of Phoenix hosted an annual meeting of small college presidents.
Yep.
And it was a Saturday evening, and after that convention was over, a fellow by the name of Dr. Roy Watson from a small private college in Moscow, Idaho, spoke at a meeting, and he primarily spoke on the younger generation of junior high and high school kids text messaging so much that it has caused them to be having so many difficulties. They cannot relate. They have a poor relational skills. They cannot finish reading a book. They can't, you know, solve math problems. And at the end of his speech, talking to some of us, he said that there is a general consensus of small college presidents that they that the faculty cannot stand the kids coming for, into the schools for them to teach because they're so ill-equipped.
Wow. Okay. Well, look, thank you for all the comments. Are we at time for a hymn?
Time for a song.
Time for a song, says Jack. Good. Let's see. I didn't talk about discipline and spanking of children, and I didn't talk about teaching moral standards in schools as part of the curriculum. And so probably 15 minutes at the beginning of, not this coming Sunday, but a week from Sunday, we'll talk about that. And then I want to get on to economics questions. And, wow, we could go on talking about this for a lot longer. I want to come back to emphasize this doesn't mean that every Hispanic and every African-American child performs poorly on tests. And it doesn't mean that every white child or Asian child obviously performs well. It just means on average, this is what's happening. There are many exceptions, and there are notable exceptions, and there are remarkable exceptions who, in fact, overcome some of the disadvantageous backgrounds that they've come from. But I come back to my basic argument. I think giving choice, giving freedom of choice, giving parental control is consistent with biblical values on how children should be trained. And that best way to introduce that choice is a voucher system. And it seems to me it would overcome a national tragedy in terms of racial inequality in education. And it's I think, the only solution that's going to work. Our Father, we thank you that you are our Father, that you treat us as your children, you care for us as your sons and daughters. Lord, we ask for your help and your intervention in our nation, that there could be a better system of training our children, not only in
academic skills, but also in right and wrong, and in character, and in qualities of their personalities that will serve our nation well in coming generations. We thank you for this time together. In Jesus' name, amen.